You are listening to a free podcast of The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. To support the show and receive nearly an hour extra material daily, become a member today at majority.fm. Resistance is futile.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
The destiny of America is always safer in the hands of the people than in the conference rooms of any elite.
Sam Cedar.
They are unanimous in their hate for me, and I welcome their hatred.
We must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
And I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Wednesday, March 20th, 2013. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live in the literal, though not metaphorical, shadow of the New York Times building, the fashionable Dollar Lunch District of New York City. Today on the program, senior editor of the New Republic, John Judas, on his piece, The Eve of Destruction, what it felt like to be within the Beltway media bubble and against the invasion and occupation of Iraq. Also on the program today, the assault weapons ban seems basically dead at this point, and perhaps even more problematic, the ban on high-capacity magazines, large-capacity magazines, also perhaps dead. We will talk about why and what it means going forward with any type of sensible gun reform. Immigration reform may be doing a little bit better. Also on today's program, the sequester. Apparently, it's not just all about White House tours and Easter egg hunts and all that and more. We will also talk about the GOP makeover. Some interesting demographics. Well, I'll tease this. While the electorate has gotten less white, everyone knows this, right? The Republican districts have gotten more white. More evidence of what we've been talking about in terms of redistricting in 2010 and the implications. And coincidentally enough, our next guest also wrote the seminal book, I think, on the changing demographics that bring us this interesting state of play. Perhaps we will discuss that with him as well. But we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to be talking to John Judas. I wanted to get that piece. We'll get it a little bit later. The Steven Crowder piece. You remember that story of the Fox News. Is he considered a reporter for them or a comedian or what?
I think he's a official contributor.
Official contributor. I mean, I have no problem, obviously, with comedians providing, you know, news stuff, obviously. or people of a comedic pedigree. But you will recall that some time ago there were there was massive protests in Michigan, it was, and union protests, and this Steven Crowder got into a kerfuffle, which really made his career in the Fox News circles. I mean, this guy was invited to CPAC, and he got punched in the face. And, of course, press charges. But here's the problem, folks. Just a little tease. When you're providing evidence to a district attorney in trying to press charges, and you have that evidence on video, you got to give them the raw video. You can't give them the cleverly edited video, because apparently that makes them very skeptical of you. that's just a little bit of a tease. We're going to take a break. When we come back, we're going to change gears and talk to John Judas about if there are any lessons that have been learned, and by whom, and are they the proper ones that we can learn on the 10-year invasion, 10-year anniversary of the invasion and occupation of Iraq, or at least the beginning. We're still almost 10 years away from the anniversary of when it ended. We'll be right back after this. We are back on the Majority Report on the phone. It is a pleasure to welcome to the program John Judas, senior editor of The New Republic and author also of a book I read when it first came out. I think it was back in 2002, The Emerging Democratic Majority, which proved to be, I don't know if the right word is prophetic, but certainly has proven to be prophetic, I guess. Welcome to the program, John.
Yeah, thank you.
So I want to talk about your piece that you wrote, obviously, to in recalling the run-up of the invasion and occupation of Iraq, the eve of destruction. Tell us, just set the table for us here on where you were, at least in the context of the broader conversation that was going on in the months before the invasion of Iraq.
Well, I was I was at the New Republic, which I'd been connected to before that for about as a staff member for about seven or 8 years, and longer than that. And I had always been on the left, if you want to put it that way, of the them on foreign policy, on Israel, but also on questions about going to war. And when the Iraq, when the Bush started to talk about going to war with Iraq, I used to think of it as me and the women. There were four women on the staff at the time, including Marty Peretz's assistant, and we were the dissenters. And most of the time, they didn't talk up on the in the meeting, so a lot of times it was just me. And it was, and my situation on the magazine was more or less reflected in official Washington, which where the dissenters were far and few between. Walter Pincus, I think, at the Washington Post. I mean, there were a bunch of us, and we knew each other, but it was we were very isolated.
The fascinating thing about your piece is that you recount that to the extent that you ran into any other people who shared your perspective on this, it was from what I guess we would perceive the least likely quarters.
Yeah, I was. I had two experiences like that. I was friends with a guy at Maryland, a professor who also taught at the war colleges. He was an expert on the history of naval warfare. And I saw him sometime, I think, in the late fall, and he told me that all the people that he knew, professors that he knew at the colleges, were also opposed to going to war. And I had a confirmation of that when I spoke at a panel at the college about the Iraq War, and the person who was going to comment on my statement was a guy, a professor in the Naval War College, and I thought he would criticize me for being against the war, but instead he criticized me for being too timid. So that was my inkling that among the military professoriate, if you want to put it that way, there was almost universal skepticism about the need to go to war. About the same time, too, I got an invitation to be part of this seminar at the CIA that was going to discuss the world in 15 or 20 years. I can't remember exactly which it was, and there were about 10 or 15 of us at these seminars, and there too, the discussion ended up being about Iraq, and I found there too that the majority of people in that seminar were opposed to the war. And about a month after it ended, I was at this big conference in Wilmington, Delaware, that the CIA holds, and a guy who was a more senior official, whose name I couldn't tell you in 100 years, pulled me aside and said, well, the reason they invited me was to this seminar was because they'd read what I'd written in the American Prospect, where I wrote my dissenting views on the subject, and that the purpose of the seminar was to try to develop this report on the world in 15 years that would implicitly have a message that we shouldn't go to war, and that it would somehow get to the White House, and that they would read it and would have second thoughts. And you know, I thought at the time, this is an incredibly indirect way to go about trying to voice your dissent, and reflected the impotence really of the intelligentsia within the CIA, the State Department too. The intelligence people in the State Department were also skeptical about the war, but really none of them had a voice. They were drowned out by this, the Washington punditocracy, the heads of the think tanks, the newspapers, TV, all that stuff, and of course by the Bush people, who were spreading all this propaganda to show that we were really in danger of a nuclear attack in Ohio from the Iraqi. I'm already on to the next.
Right.
Subject from the Saddam and the Iraqi WMD. So anyway, it was this kind of case. The people who knew anything weren't listened to, and the people who didn't know anything were dominating the discussion. That was my experience.
And I mean, how are we to account for this? I mean, because so often we hear, when it came to things like the surge, or when it came to the surge in Afghanistan, so often listening to the military, listening to the CIA is listening to these different military institutions is used as a cudgel. You know, the idea that you wouldn't listen to the troops, that you wouldn't listen to the brass. How is it that it got so turned around?
Well, you mean how did it get turned around in the early 2000s on Iraq?
Yeah, I mean, how is it?
Well, the simplest explanation is the September 11th that created a kind of national trauma. And if you remember, that was followed by the anthrax, which was a really big deal in Washington. I remember we live in the suburbs, an hour away, but still checking my mail very carefully each day. That really shuffled the deck in terms of who was going to be listened to. And I think within the Bush administration, it gave the neoconservatives a hearing that they really didn't have before that, and put on the agenda things that, like invading Iraq, that really otherwise would never have gotten there. So I think that the trauma of that event was the single thing that made it possible to sell that war to the American people.
Yeah, I mean, I think I would agree. I mean, there's a quality of it that this is an extraordinary circumstance on some level, because there was just an astonishing amount of so the nation was still in very much, I think, in shock in a lot of ways.
Right.
And
also the other thing I'd add is we'd had this seeming success in Afghanistan where within 2 or 3 months after it looked very much that we were going to be in a quagmire there, suddenly we got, you know, Mullah Omar was in Pakistan and the government had fallen. So it seemed like on the other side that it was going to be easy to do things like invade Iraq, get rid of Saddam and install a new government. I think those were the two things. So you had shock on the one hand and overconfidence on the other, and that was a deadly combination.
Now, I mean, and if you, but if you parse for a moment the I guess the, I mean, just to use a metaphor, the state of the patient, as it were, okay?
And the patient, state of the what?
Of the patient. The patient in this instance being,
okay.
You know, the American psyche, I guess. And they're in a state of shock. What does it say about the dynamic and the way that this information is disseminated? Because they could be in a state of shock, but it doesn't necessarily mean, and they could be more amenable to being sold this. But it's interesting that you've got these, you know, journalists being invited to CIA seminars, journalists being chastised by war college professors for not being out in front enough and being desperate enough to, you know, sort of seeking this vehicle in which to communicate to the American public, and the vehicle sort of just not being there in many respects.
Well, I'm not sure what it says. I was after that experience, and I wrote something. Spencer Ackerman and I did a long piece on the CIA after the war had begun, and after it was clear that the misinformation had been peddled. And then I went back to Moynihan, Pat Moynihan, the senator's ideas about intelligence and the dangers that he ascribed to having a secret intelligence apparatus and not having things more transparent. And to me, that was an important lesson that we still haven't learned. About having more public debate, I think that the existence of all these secret agencies that don't publish these incredibly redacted reports it makes it possible for the government to deceive the people. In many ways, I'm not sympathetic to the WikiLeaks guy, but on the other hand, a lot of the information that came out of that was information that we should have known about.
Right.
So it's again, I think it's the culture of secrecy in the government, and I think that remains a problem to this day.
This may be a little bit off topic, but I'm curious about this because I think this speaks a little bit to the dynamic that I'm getting at. Why, if you perceive this secrecy and this lack of transparency to be so problematic that it would lead us into what is, you know, I think, you know, by, I don't think there, it's a controversial statement to say this is the worst foreign policy blunder that this country has been engaged in the past 40 some odd years. Why not be sympathetic to WikiLeaks? I mean, if it is serving that function,
I wrote something that was sympathetic at the time, so it's not. You're not going to get a great answer from me on that. I mean, I'm not crazy about the idea that I just finished a book on the history of the U.S., Palestine, and Israel, and I've been through the archive, and I've read a lot of consular reports, the reports that junior people send back to the State Department about what's really happening and what's happening, and a lot of those are done somewhat informally. I think that they would be a lot different if people thought that they were going to be publicized. So there is an element, I think, there is an element to be concerned about all that stuff just being thrown out into the public. But again, what I'd say is, given our experience with Iraq, there's a reason to worry more about the secrecy than about the revelation.
Right.
So that's the
yeah.
Okay.
I'm
giving you a qualified answer about.
No, and I think that and that's fair. But I ask because I think there's, you know, one of the things. I mean, my experience in sort of seeing the public discourse in the lead up to Iraq was that while the country was in a state of shock, and presumably this also is. Journalists are not immune from this. You're checking your mail in the Washington area for anthrax at that time. But there seemed to be a real sort of an intimidation that many journalists and opinion disseminators and pundits had from the conventional wisdom. Sort of built into this sort of notion of credentialism that if you were not sufficiently pro-war, you would lose status. You mentioned the piece that you and Spencer wrote that got you disinvited from certain functions. And I've certainly heard told that you could ostracize yourself in some respects by being too by offering too much dissent. The paradox here is that the most credentialed of people were, in many respects, against the war. The credentials that were the most intimidating had more to do with the media, in some respects, than it did, in fact, with the experts.
Well, it had to do with the political class, though. I mean, it had to do with the appointees from the Bush administration in the in the top jobs at Defense and Pentagon, you know, things like that. I think they were really the key people in spreading the lies, and also in intimidating the press. I think you'd have to put them way at the top. And I thought Tenet played an irresponsible role at the at the CIA,
without a doubt. I mean, it's reprehensible, I would even argue. Because I think about how the people that I knew that who would have otherwise been skeptical were swayed by commentators like Thomas Friedman. Almost as if, you know, if Thomas Friedman has signed on to this, it can't be wrong. I mean, on some level, at one point it was the dissemination that this needed to be sold to the American public. And the American public really, I think for the most part, they probably knew Richard Pearl far more than they should have. But that, again, is a function of the press. I mean, these people, you know, there's no direct line to the American people from these upper echelon political appointees in the Bush administration to the American people. There has to be some complicity from the media. And I wonder if that dynamic, that sort of credentialism that we find within the media, whether there was any lesson to be learned there or whether that lesson has been learned.
Yeah, I'm not sure. You know, our ability to follow foreign policy has been shrunk by the destruction of the American print media. I mean, I think maybe the New York Times is the only major newspaper now that has outlets around the world. The Washington Post has closed a lot of its bureaus, so we don't even have that check that we had against official Washington. And, you know, in the Vietnam War, that played an enormous role. The correspondents in the field, they're reporting back things that were completely different from what the government was saying. So,
did we have that check then, though?
I guess I'm saying the situation is actually worse in some ways.
Yeah, I mean, did we have that check then? I mean, it seems to me that the New York Times, I mean, was, you know, a fulcrum.
Yeah, yeah, but nobody was in Iraq. That was a big problem. There were the McClatchy people were good, but I think that you had Judith Miller. I guess she was actually in Iraq. You had all these. It really was a crazy time because you had this group of people around the Iraqi National Congress with Chalabi, who were giving this inside information to journalists that they thought they were getting the real scoop. I hope it was an unusual time, but maybe not.
Have you read much in terms of the, you know, this is another occasion where we see sort of mea culpas that are, I don't know what the Latin term for sort of is, but we see these sort of mea culpas in the press today, these days. David Frum coming out and sort of trying to wriggle out of responsibility. We see Richard Pearl has been brought out. He's not mea culpaing at all, but there are others. And I just wonder if perhaps we don't, you know, perhaps we are in no different place, really. The only difference in terms of the dynamic, which was problematic then, the only difference, the dynamic is the same. The only difference is that we don't have that shock and that we are really just one shock away of being able to get into the same mess.
That may be true. I think of the neoconservatives in Washington along the lines of Nightmare on Elm Street. You know, that movie where the Freddy Krueger keeps coming back. You think he's been destroyed, and then sure enough, back he comes. So, yes, we've had this for 20 years now of thinking that that we're not going to do crazy things anymore, and then back we go. So I'm not sure if we're immune. I think Iran is going to be a big test.
And where's that? I mean, where does that? I mean, I get, you know, I don't want to just keep hammering the same point. But, you know, the neocons are always going to be there if we assume that. But it's to use your Nightmare on Elm Street analogy, the problem is that Elm Street hasn't changed. You know, uh-huh. Freddy Krueger keeps coming back, but Elm Street is, you know, nobody's done anything different on Elm Street. To, you know, how many times does he have to come back before people start to, like, we got to lock our doors, maybe, or maybe we should have, you know, a neighborhood watch or something.
Yeah, well, Elm Street changes a little. For instance, to my amazement, if you look at the Chuck Hagel hearings, the neoconservatives were more or less dominated the Republican discourse at that time on a subject like Israel, where they 20 years ago they weren't identified with at all. So, Elm Street does change a little, but not necessarily for the better. Yes, it's a problem. I agree with you.
Well, and so let me just turn to, because I'm very happy to have the opportunity to talk to you just about your the emerging Democratic majority just briefly. This is a book that you wrote in 2002 that essentially has really the predictions or the what you perceived was happening in terms of the demographics in this country have now really come into relief. And I just want to get your thoughts on what happens from here, because it seems that the Republican Party was completely caught flat-footed in terms of these demographic shifts, and is almost too wed to the way that they had constructed their majorities in the past to really to really change in any fashion. I mean, the analogy that I use is sort of the Red Sox before pre 2004, where the fans just wanted to get into the playoffs, and so the team could never really have that rebuilding year that they needed to have because they had to be just good enough to maintain the demands of the fans. And it seems almost the Republicans are in that same situation. They can't really have a rebuilding year. And if they don't, they're going to be a permanent minority, at least as far as, you know, they can, assuming they can't redistrict more than they already have.
Well, let's get back to baseball for a minute. The Cubs had the same problem, too, incidentally, after 2003. Well, we didn't rebuild, and now we're, you know. And anyway, yes, that's a nice way of thinking about the Republicans. The only thing I'd say, though, is that because of political mistakes that the Obama people made in those first 2 years, the Republicans have the House. They're going to keep it, I think, for a lot of this decade, and they still have a lot of governorships. They still have a base in the country that's sufficient to at least as a veto, and so they're not as in bad shape as they were in the 1930s, for instance. But the problem you cite is a real one, because their base doesn't permit them to make the kind of adjustments that would be necessary to win national elections. I mean, I thought last summer that Romney would have had a good chance. I mean, I thought he had a good chance at the time if he had turned to the center at the convention, chosen Portman instead of Ryan, and he did turn to the center in about a month, but it was really too late, and then you had the 47% thing, and he was finished. But again, I don't think he could do that because there would have been such an uproar at the convention. So they are kind of stuck, but they're not decimated. They have a real base in the country.
And I just want to get your sense on when we talk about Freddy Krueger, the notion of a grand bargain and the idea of entitlement reform. It seems like, and by entitlement reform, I'm talking about cuts to Medicare or Social Security. That really seems to be the monster that will not die. And it seems that it's not dying because, to a certain extent, well, not to a certain extent. I mean, it's on the White House website. That offer is continually dangled out there by the administration for anybody who will jump at it. I mean, give me your take on the politics of that and how.
Well, I was thinking about that when you were talking about the media, and Krugman wrote about this too. I spoke at a conference of German and American newspaper editors about a month ago, and I was just amazed at the extent to which the American editors, who were editors of big shot newspapers or editorial page editors and editorial page editors, agreed with the kind of conventional wisdom about debts and deficits and entitlements, and we have this terrible problem in our country, and neither the Republicans or the Democrats will budge, and what we need is a compromise. I think. And I think you can't attribute that to manipulation from Washington. It comes up through the colleges, I'm not sure, but that ideology is extraordinarily powerful. And I think, as far as the country's future, it's completely wrong. I don't think that the problem in our economy lies in deficits. I don't think it lies in entitlements. So. It's a disturbing problem, and I think that I worry that the Obama people will give in on this the way they they gave in a lot during his first term.
I don't know if the dynamic is that they're giving in or it's simply that they're actually pursuing it. I mean, it is another one of those Elm Street scenarios where the establishment conventional wisdom is this notion of deficit and debt hysteria. I would argue that it's a function of essentially a wealthy establishment, essentially, that is protecting their own interests. It's hard to say that this is the administration giving in on this, because they seem to be the ones who are pursuing it as vigorously as anybody else. I mean, the Republicans can talk in general terms about cutting Social Security and Medicare, but they can't possibly do it on their own. And they need the Obama administration. The Obama administration, to the extent that they are not able to carry out their agenda of this so-called entitlement reform, it seems to be just a function of they need to get revenues as some type of cover, and that's a poison pill for the Republicans.
Well, again, I don't have any real inside information on this subject. I listen to what the president says at times, and I heard him when he told the Republicans that he didn't think deficits were a problem. My feeling about them is that if they were able to do so, they would present a program and a budget that did not contain any significant entitlement reform that spent a lot on infrastructure and investments for the future, and had tax cuts that were heavily weighted toward the wealthy. I think Obama believes that he can't get that, and that he has to compromise in order to prevent a much worse situation in terms of cuts, budget cuts. And he's invited that by agreeing to this sequester stuff a year and a half ago in August of 2011. So,
do you think that was an inadvertent invitation? I mean, because we know from Gene Sperling in his email to Bob Woodward, putting aside the intimidation factor, but we know that he is claiming that was part of the DNA of this sequester, was to force a situation that brought about entitlement reform and increased revenue.
Oh, I think they thought that the Republicans would be so worried about the military side of it that they'd agree to a deal. I think it was just I think it was a miscalculation, and that whole period was just a period of all. I think it was the darkness before the dawn in terms of the administration. It was an end point. July, August of 2011, they just made terrible mistakes, and I think they realized they did afterwards. But the mistake with the sequester was a tactical one.
Yeah, so I would certainly agree that it was a failure from a tactical standpoint, but I also think that what they were pursuing with that sequester was also problematic. My sense is that the dawn is a little hazy.
Well, that's fine. Yeah, but it's not like they're wedded to this kind of fiscal austerity. They aren't, and to the extent that they seem to court that, it is out of a political desperation rather than out of any conviction. That's what I think.
Well, I hope you're right, and I hope that
it won't make any difference if I'm right if they end up making the deal.
Well, my hope is that lack of conviction that lack of conviction in some way implicates their ability to make that deal. But I suspect I'm rather bet at this point on the inability of Boehner to get his caucus to vote for increased revenues as the saving grace for Social Security and Medicare, as sort of perverse as that sounds. But John Judith, real pleasure to talk to you today. Thank you so much.
Yeah, good talking to you.
All right. We've got to take a break, folks. And when we do, or when we return, we will take your phone calls at 646-257-3920. We will also, look, I know there's a lot of people who, you know, sort of enjoy the idea of some Fox News provocateur getting punched in the face. And that's all well and good. But I think you undoubtedly had some feelings of queasiness or guilt in sort of, you don't want to be rooting on for anybody to be punched in the face. Well, some of you may not want to root for somebody being punched in the face. And you probably felt, well, I don't feel comfortable being so pro punch that guy in the face. But if you stick around for the better half of the program, I'm going to assuage your guilt. All right, folks, just a reminder, a little bit of housekeeping. For those of you who are joining us for the first time, we have lots of people who are tuning into the program for the first and second time, perhaps after my appearance on Up With Chris. I am in the midst of the both aspects of the life cycle. As it were, my son was born 12 days ago, and as such, I had planned to take next week off, and my 101-year-old grandmother passed away Monday, and so I am now going to be taking off a couple of days to go to the funeral. However, Matt and Michael will be taking over the show for the next 3 days, I believe. It's a drop-off. I'm not going to lie to you. The quality of the program is going to drop off, but not – we have such margin. We have such margin. Well, it may be precipitously, but that doesn't matter because the quality of this program is already so far and above any other audio content that you can get out there in terms of politics that even a precipitous drop in the quality of this program still places it above the quality of really any other program that you can get. So I would encourage you to tune in.
I don't know what you're talking about. I have a great show planned for tomorrow.
Listen. There's no doubt in my mind that you have a great show planned for tomorrow. But my point is, even still, even if it's a great show, which I have no doubt it will be, when it is a great show, it still will be a little bit, you know, a little bit diminished in quality.
I don't appreciate the guest host of the Matt and Michael show saying this.
Yes. I may not be.
I need to find another permanent sub.
All right, folks. What we will do is Matt and Michael will be holding down the fort over the next couple of days. I imagine these guys will talk with Cliff on Friday, as per usual. And then next week, we will have new content for you in addition to live content. So Matt and Michael will host the show on Monday. And then Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday, Friday, one of those days we may have off. But a couple of those days we'll have new material for you. Interviewed Stephen Brill for Ring of Fire, but I did an extended version for the Majority Report. He's got a blockbuster piece in Time magazine, which dovetails nicely with some conversations I had back when I was at Families USA talking about medical expenses. We will present that material to you. We have some other interviews that I will have pre-recorded. And we will also provide you with some archive material. So there'll be plenty of new content for you next week. And members will get some choice archive stuff. So you will be taken care of. Perhaps I might be able to call in on Friday. I don't know. Or certainly I may be able to call in on Monday. Briefly, just to touch base. So I will be back live in full control of the program April 2nd, missing my 9-year anniversary in radio. Well, that's sad, but I'll get over it. But in the meantime, folks, you can celebrate that anniversary by becoming a member of the Majority Report. It is your subscriptions which support and provide 98% of the revenue for this program. So if you like the programming, you enjoy it, it's a big part of your week, please support it. Independent media, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. You can also buy your coffee at justcoffee.coop, a great fair trade, employee-owned co-op in out of Madison, Wisconsin. Use the coupon code MAJORITY, get 10% off fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. If you buy stuff through Amazon, folks, go to majority.fm, click on the support the show link, find the Amazon link. It's a big one there. Just bookmark it. Buy all your stuff through there. You won't notice a difference whatsoever, but we will get a kickback, and it'll be much appreciated. All right, we will see you in the better half of the program. The number is 646-257-3920, 646-257-3920, and you can IM me at Majority FM. We'll be right back after this.